Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and Susanna Caldwell, also of the Alaska Dispatch. Steve, Wednesday, the Senate was poised to take up a constitutional amendment that would allow the state to provide state funds for private education. But what do you know? It was taken off the calendar and sent back to the Rules Committee.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, I think the primary supporters of this bill, Senator Mike Dunleavy of Wasilla, they started counting votes and they realized that they weren't close to having the number they needed to get this thing passed. This is not just a constitutional amendment, a proposed amendment to the Constitution. They need two-thirds majority of both houses, the Senate and the House, to get this thing on the ballot. And they realized that they were a few votes short. There's a pretty solid block, or at least it appears to be a solid block of eight no votes right now.
These are people who have publicly said they're against it.
They're against it, yeah.
They've taken the position.
Yeah, so rather than push this bill out onto the floor and have it go down in flames, and then that would be the end of it, they decided to take it off the floor, put it into the Rules Committee, so it goes back there, and it keeps the bill alive, and it allows its supporters to go out and perhaps twist a few more arms or do whatever they do to try and persuade people to support it. So they can bring it back up for another vote perhaps later on in the session.
What I thought that, as a friend of mine, former legislator, pointed out, we're getting down in days in the session, and that perhaps the sponsors just felt, we got to do something. We got to try shake things up here.
Yeah.
Because they have to pass both houses by these super majorities, as you indicated.
And there's, and as you said too, Michael, there's some huge issues out there that are going to really command a lot of time and energy from legislators. You've got gas line issues and things like that, and more of these other important and big issues are going to get shoved to the side as we get closer to the deadline of the session ending. But yeah, it may, you know, probably if you are in favor of this constitutional amendment, it was probably patience is a virtue here, and you live to fight another day, because if you force the issue, then that's it. The issue is done for.
And Senator Dunleavy of the Valley, Mike Dunleavy, mm-hmm. said he's got some legal information coming, or legal opinions or something. It sounds like I'm going to bring the secret sauce into the the Rules Committee, and we're going to get this straightened out.
That's right. It was pretty, you know,
was the word we're looking
details.
For amorphous?
There were no details like, oh, you've got this, it's coming, don't you worry, and then you'll see, and then it'll be okay, and then you can vote. So, yeah.
Come on in the tent.
Yeah, so we'll see what this information is. It wasn't something that was coming from Alaska. It sounded like it was coming from outside the state, and then he was going to, you know,
I think what he's up against is once you get people taking public positions, it's really difficult to get them to change. Yeah. It has to be a big reason. If you're doing the budget, it can be, well, yeah, I got something for my district. This is not like that.
This is not, and we see a microcosm of this debate down there in Juneau.
Right.
This is a debate that's taking place all across the state of Alaska right now. The lawmakers are getting an earful from a lot of people who do not want to see this legislation pass. They do not want to see school vouchers. They don't want to see what they perceive as giving public schools the short shrift in all of this. You know, now the supporters say that's not going to happen, but there again, that the perception is for a lot of people out there who support public schools are saying this is bad. This is bad legislation.
Yeah, saying it over and over. Jill, in the House of Representatives, Guarantor of Anchorage has a bill to require schools to teach students about sexual assault and sexual abuse. What does she have in mind?
This is patterned off a national initiative called Aaron's Law. Aaron is a young woman who was herself sexually abused while she was growing up, and she's kind of become a one-woman crusader to make sure that children have the knowledge and the language available to them to know what's happening and then to report it. And her point is, you know, look, when I was growing up, I learned how to stop, drop, and roll. I learned how to deal with earthquakes. I knew what I had to do in the case of a tornado. None of those threats ever came and visited me. But you mm-hmm. know which threat did? Sexual abuse. And I had no idea what to do. And so she really believes that that's important for children. The state of Alaska does not have state-mandated curriculum requirements related to sexual assault and sexual abuse for the state's school children. It's recommended, but it's not required to be implemented. So it's left up to the districts. A lot of districts do provide some measure of this education, either specifically as a breakaway piece or as the health curriculums that are developed to age with the child as the child goes through grade school, middle school, high school. So there are very likely some places where the curriculums could be more robust, but I know, for example, in Anchorage, they've had it in place for years and years and years.
And the teachers are certified in some fashion?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, oh, well, you mean what Representative Tarr is seeking?
Yeah.
Yes, it provides for some continuing education, I believe, and requires that the teachers get educated on it either prior to the school year and then in routine increments afterwards, so
now,
that they're up to speed.
Sometimes when the legislature has mandated additions to the curriculum, for example, Alaska history, it's cut into other time, and that has been the concern of there's only so much time in the school day. But here they believe they can work it into the health curriculum. Is that how this is going to go?
I can tell you how the Anchorage School District is doing theirs. So they have a health curriculum that grows and matures with children from the time they're very small children. And so they're not going to use age inappropriate language or imagery when dealing with, say, a third grader or a fourth grader, but they're going to give them the tools and the language to understand, safe touch, bad touch, or, touch that feels good, touch that they don't like, and what to do about it, and to develop relationships with school personnel, nurses, teachers, know the people who are safe that they can go to if something isn't quite right. And then as they get older, it could start getting into dating and relationships, domestic violence, these sorts of things where we see problems in people's lives.
And then it becomes an integrated, there's a lengthy curriculum.
There. Yes, right. Okay. Yeah.
Susanna, welcome back. You covered the Iditarod. This was one of the most remarkable Iditarods in the history of the event, starting with the lack of snow. What are some of the highlights? What are some of your lasting impressions?
Oh man, this was a crazy year for everyone out there. I mean, I think the biggest thing that's on everybody's minds right now is the finish. It was one of the most memorable in the last 20 years, easily. The Iditarod was more like NASCAR than a 1,000-mile sled dog race. You had Jeff King, who looked to be cruising to his fifth win, which would have been a record. There's only one other musher who has that distinction.
Swenson, Rick Swenson.
Mm-hmm. He had an hour lead leaving White Mountain. It seemed insurmountable, but then the weather
got... And remind us, how far is White Mountain from the finish line?
White Mountain is about 77 miles from the finish, and usually it's a pretty good cruise in. Again, if you have a good lead there, it's pretty hard to be overcome. However, he was hit by bad weather. The trail between White Mountain and Nome was icy, especially once you hit the coast.
Well, you had a very dramatic first-person interview with him.
I did, yeah. I was lucky to speak to him, and yeah, he was basically blown off course by the wind, because the ice with the wind, the dogs just couldn't get any traction, and so they kept doing barrel rolls, he kept getting bounced around, and so finally he just said, okay, I'm going to take a little break. He was about 3 miles from safety, and he stopped, and he tried to anchor the dogs down to rest them, and hoping that the weather would improve, and it didn't. And he ended up walking back to safety.
Tell us about the dog pile. This is one of the great images of
right.
the race.
So it's very windy. He was trying to bed the dogs down. Of course, he couldn't keep them warm. So he unhooked them, and he basically had them in this giant dog pile with the sleeping bag over them. He was lying down, his back sort of to the wind, trying to keep that wind away from them because they were so
frightened. I think this is something... Nobody would try except in desperation.
Right. No, it was definite desperation. And if a musher like Jeff King, someone who's so successful, is willing to go that far, I think it shows just how terrible the conditions were. So anyway, he felt like he had no other options except maybe walk to safety. He had all his clothes on. He couldn't keep going in the position that he was in. And so he decided to walk. He got about 2 miles from his dogs, only about a mile left until he reached safety. Some snow machines came by, and he decided to accept a ride. Right. Unfortunately, in the race rules, that's considered outside assistance, and he was forced to scrap.
And this year, the mushers have devices by which they can alert authorities, and if they're in an emergency situation, get rescued, right? And he, for whatever reason, chose not to do that.
Right, right. It was sort of a controversial element of the race this year. There were the spot trackers, these SOS beacons that you can press and alert authorities to come help you. Some people pressed it and they later regretted it, saying, oh, I pressed it too soon. Others who were in really serious danger, like Scott Jansen, the Mushin mortician, he broke his leg on the run between Rhone and Nikolai. He ended up having to press that, and that was a very serious situation for him. He was really hurt. So, yeah, Jeff didn't think that he needed to press it, though. He thought he could get to safety, warm up, recover, and then make it back to his dogs and
continue racing. Let's talk about the winner.
Dallas Seavey, yeah. it was a surprise for, I think, everyone watching the race. And he says that even for him it was a surprise that he didn't think that he had beat Jeff or Allie. He thought that he was racing his dad, who was coming up behind him, Mitch Seavey. But yeah, he won his second Iditarod in record time. And he beat the record by about 5 hours. And so, yeah, he's thrilled, obviously. I think when I last saw him, it was still sort of sinking in that he had
done
it again.
And that wonderful picture that only the Iditarod has of the championship musher with his lead dog covered with roses. That is priceless.
Well, and I think, you know, Michael, you were bringing up earlier, I think you guys should talk about the start of the race, because they thought about maybe they should leave from Fairbanks. The weather's so
you
bad.
You talked about the start of the race.
We don't have enough snow. It's icy. The trail committee had to do a lot of work to get that trail even navigable for these mushers, to get it started out of Willow. And then they had horrendous conditions, and I know, Susanna, you saw what it was like as these guys were dropping down into Rhone and then on into Nikolai. And we have this incredible footage that King shot dropping through the Dalzell Gorge, showing just how treacherous it was and kind of what they were up against. And I think some mushers are still angry about that.
Yeah, that was interesting that a number of mushers expressed anger. There's no other word for it.
Well, they contend that the trail was misrepresented to them. Every year there's a mandatory musher meeting before the race, the start of the race, and they're told about trail conditions, and they were actually shown pictures of the trail, and they contend that those pictures were taken weeks ahead of the meeting and that the trail conditions were not what they were shown to be. And yeah, I mean, it started out rough, going through the Happy River Steps, which is a really difficult portion of the trail. Some mushers got banged up there, but a few were saying, hey, where's this bad trail? And then they went through, from Rainy Pass, they left heading to Rhone through the Dalzell Gorge, and it was just
a
nightmare. It was a sheer nightmare. Every single musher said that it was the worst mushing they've ever encountered.
You've got no resistance on your sleds, no resistance for your dogs. You have these charged up teams that are at the front end of the race. Poor Didi Jonro, who has raced this race, 30 some odd times, wasn't strong enough to control her team. That's what she ended up saying, is that she just finally, after losing her team, losing her sled a couple of times, enough is enough.
Steve, go ahead.
Well, I was just curious, a question for Susanna. What do you think the percentage of mushers that actually train on at least portions of the Iditarod Trail prior to the race? I mean, certainly you have mushers along the coastline that they'll go up from Unalakleet to Nome. Maybe they'll train on that section of the trail or whatever before the race starts. Did anybody go through the interior part to see the conditions firsthand before the race, do you know?
The mushers, did they go through the interiors?
Yeah. Did they? I'm curious if anybody trained.
Oh, I mean, I think that there are mushers who live out in that area and definitely did train out there. I know some mushers from Western Alaska actually traveled into the interior to train, because out in Bethel, for example, they had absolutely no snow out there. So, yeah, they did go in there. And a lot of people along the trail were complaining. They had wished that the trail had been rerouted from Fairbanks, down this Yukon River route. That didn't happen. I mean, a lot of mushers out there said that the trail that they saw between Rainy Pass and Nikolai was the worst they'd ever seen in all of their years of mushing, and that absolutely nothing could have prepared them for that trail. I mean, everyone from rookies to seasoned veterans, it was incredible.
Steve, I'm wondering, do you think the organizers and the rulers of the race here are going to be forced to think about changes they might make, because in some we had scrapes broken bones. Oh, we had some injuries.
It was a demolition derby.
We didn't have anything more serious. I mean, these are serious, but nobody died.
No, thank goodness, no one. And you know, broken bones. That's bad enough. But the mushers that I know, I used to know quite a few more than I do now, but they're not shy people, and they are very quick to let everybody know their opinion about things. So I'm sure that Stan Hooley, who runs the Iditarod race, he's going to get an earful, and some kind of changes will be made. At least they'll have some contingency plans, perhaps, in place in case something like this happens again in the future. I can't see them calling off a race. I wouldn't see that. Maybe if the conditions are so bad and mushers get taken by surprise, perhaps there's a refund of your $1,000 entry. I don't know, but there's a lot more money that goes into preparing for that race than just that $1,000 entry fee. Certainly that it was pretty treacherous, and it was alarming how rough it was and how people did get banged up.
Let's go
and
back to one of the
things. How many sleds broke too?
That is Ellie Zirkel. She did finish second, and this is, I believe, the third time she's finished second.
Yes.
So tell us about her finish and what she had to say afterwards.
Well, I think that she was a bit shocked. She is a fierce competitor, and she wants to win. There is no doubt about this. She's nice and bubbly and warm, but that all underlies this intense drive to win. And she was disappointed. She was still happy, but disappointed. You know, she, you know, will probably spend the rest of her life wondering if the decision to stop in safety for about 2 hours cost her the race, because she stayed stopped in safety, waiting out the storm. Well, Dallas Seavey, you know, he came from behind, he got into safety, and he just took off. He didn't spend any time there.
You know, that race to have a number two behind you trying to close the gap for first position is really remarkable. Ramey Smith is kind of like the historical come-from-behind guy. Mm-hmm. But Allie made an incredible effort. She was, 19 minutes behind Dallas, and she closed the gap. I mean, she finished 2 minutes and 20 seconds behind him, which is just amazing. So not only did she gain time, but she came so close to overtaking him. Mm-hmm. And she must have thought that, you know, after she learned King was out, that it was, you know, her race.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for the Iditarod update. Steve, headline. Mm-hmm. Parnell defends oil tax appointee. His appointment to the State Assessment Review Board, that is. And that same day, his appointee, Dennis Mandel of California, withdrew.
Yeah.
It was a pretty dramatic scene in the Capitol.
This is kind of an odd story. This really is a little different. This assessments board basically determines, for instance, what's the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline worth, and it assesses a tax based on that. And the money, it's important for places like Barrow and Valdez and Fairbanks, where the pipeline goes through. They potentially get millions of dollars in taxes from this assessment. It also is important for the oil companies because it determines how much in the way of taxes they have to pay as well. So Governor Parnell felt that the tax assessment was a little too high, fired one of the members of the board, Marty McGee, and now appointed Dennis Mandel to replace this person on the board. And Mandel is from California. He's been a long time.
He lived here at one time.
Lived here one time in the 90s.
He has a business in California.
Yeah. And I think he's been described as an oil executive, and I think he's not an oil executive. He's not somebody way higher in the upper echelons of an oil company, but he has worked in the oil industry for a long time. But the fact that he's not from Alaska, the fact that he's from California, this alarmed a lot of people in the legislature, including Republicans. And he spoke with a number of people in Juneau, and he felt he was going to have a real tough time being approved for this position. So he withdrew his name. Now, the governor says that he had every right to appoint an outsider, a person from California or any other place in the lower 48, to this board. The Constitution says he does. Legislators kind of say, well, he may be right about that he may have that right.
One thing, Steve, that was really interesting and surprising in the press conference that Parnell had roughly at the same time that Mandel withdrew and Bernie Washington had his hearing at before the Senate Finance Committee, his confirmation hearing. Parnell said, made it quite clear that what he intended was for the board members he was appointing to lower the value of the pipeline. There was no ambiguity about this.
No,
and that would, of course, affect the taxes that the companies pay.
Yeah, to say something like that flat out, it's
certainly surprising.
It really is. You know, you got to wonder who he's representing at this particular point. And it's got to sit on, it's got to really alarm some folks, especially in places like Barrow and Fairbanks and Valdez. Like, okay, are you our governor, or are you the oil company's governor, or what's the end game here? And obviously, he's trying to lower costs for the oil industry, it would seem, by that statement.
Right. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about Bernie Washington, who is the CFO here at Alaska Public Media. He has drawn attention, but far less than Mandel. Mostly the attention has come to he's drawn attention because of a long career in the oil industry, something like 35 years. He had a hearing before the Senate Finance Committee this same day that Mandel withdrew. This would be Thursday. And I would call the hearing essentially perfunctory. It was about 15 to 18 minutes long. And the questions weren't very probing. There were a couple of policy questions, but they didn't really, they asked him about his experience, but they didn't really ask the kind of questions that front page attention would generate, which was one, given your experience with the oil industry and all the years you worked there, do you get a pension from the oil industry? Second, do you have oil industry stocks? Third, How are we going to manage them, or what kind of objectivity will you bring to this? Now, I've talked to Bernie Washington several times, and he has insisted to me that he, in effect, would be an umpire. I call him like I see him, that I'm driven by, I believe in facts. I don't, the political process is not something that turns me on. What I'm really turned on is by going in and getting the facts and rendering the best judgment possible based on the facts. That's his position. But that sort of comes up against Parnell, who's saying, I want you to get to a certain result, which is lowering the tax
lower
on the pipeline.
Tax. Yeah.
So that's where we are on that for the moment.
Yeah. Like I said, it's kind of an amazing statement to make when you're trying to come up with what you would hope would be an impartial jury, so to speak, to pass judgment on what taxes should be.
Okay, Jill, Governor Parnell, in another measure that's been controversial, the governor's had a lot going his way, but this week it's been kind of a tough one for him, has submitted his revised water use permitting bill, which is House Bill 77. And the legislature gave it some attention, and the public gave it some attention, and for the most part, the public's attention was not laudatory.
No, the public is not pleased with this. This is a carryover from last year. It didn't do well last year. The administration made some tweaks to it, some amendments to try to soften the areas where the public had great disagreement on. Those areas generally were with general permits, water reservations, and appeals. And it kind of boils down to the public felt like this was giving too much power to the Department of Natural Resources, where previously it didn't have permitting authority, so it was reaching beyond the scope of where it normally would be, and also that it was restricting and removing, in some cases, public comment. And so here is the administration saying, here's our kinder, softer water and land use bill, or water authorization bill for permitting. We hope you like it, signed the administration. And then there was this very kind of terse, well-controlled public hearing for it in the legislature, and people were cut off right after their 2 minutes of talking. The hearing closed at an hour and a half in. There were people filled in legislative information offices around the state, standing, waiting to give their comment, who weren't able to participate.
And if I might, Jill, that's a style of running a hearing. There's another style, which is to say, we're going to stay here all night, we're going to hear everybody, we're going to hear everything they have to say.
Yes.
And then if it turns into be a drone fest, the legislators accept that, right?
Right, yes. And so this was kind of the irony, though, is that the big beef is you're eliminating public comment, we need to be able to give comment, and they're so tightly controlling the ability of the public to weigh on the legislation that's going to change this factor to begin with. But they since are opening up an additional comment period on, or hearing, an additional public hearing on this that is taking place Friday, I believe. So there will be some more room to give opinions.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there because Steve McDonald has time for one last topic.
Oh,
Steve,
yeah.
Guns on campus, guns, yes. In the, guns on campus, guns in the Capitol. The right to bear arms is getting more attention than Juneau.
It is. This is like, I think everybody, this is the race to get a good grade from the NRA. So this is just it. Yeah, it was Senator Coghill of the Fairbanks area.
The majority leader.
Majority leader. He's got some clout. His aide came out and said, you know, UAA students, UAF students, college students in Alaska should have the right to carry their guns on campus. Why should they give up this right because they're on a college campus? So this is the move, is to allow college students on campus to bring their gun to school.
And there's some discussion of perhaps even allowing guns in the Capitol, which are specifically prohibited now.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be an interesting floor debate, wouldn't it?
My favorite part of that was the proponents were saying, no, we'll allow guns in the Capitol, but you can't bring them into the gallery.
Yeah.
Now, the word gallery sometimes is used with the word shooting. I noticed that.
Yeah.
The other thing is that, I mean, if you can imagine some 18-year-old page telling somebody who's armed, sir, you can't bring that firearm into the gallery.
Yeah.
Pretty tough going.
Yeah. Maybe there's just be, you know, anything you say on this thing, you get painted
this is a matter for philosophers as well as politicians, and we'll leave it at that. Thank you for joining us on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.